Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhart. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 141, that's right, 141, Naval Thunder Wargaming with Adrian Benson. So as you can guess by the title of the show, we have a very special episode here for you because we get a guest. So whether you're a longtime listener or a new listener, I am sure you're going to enjoy this episode. And I want to remind you that we're going to cover all sorts of stuff in this episode, but it's hard to remember that. You're probably going to be on your commute or maybe at the gym or gaming, painting or whatever. The one thing you need to remember above all else is the link to the show notes. Remember wargamingrecon.com/WR141. That's wargamingrecon.com/WR141. It'll have links to all the stuff we talk about and just everything. So just keep that in mind. Now I want to welcome our very special guest. Adrian, how are you today?
Hey, John. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I loved when you were on for our HazaCon episode 2015. That was episode 136. It feels like a long time ago, but it really wasn't.
No, not really.
So one of the cool things that we're going to be talking about today is this set of rules called Naval Thunder Wargaming. And I know you kind of have a soft spot, I guess you could say, for naval wargaming, partly because you're a submariner.
Yeah, that's true. The thing with naval wargaming, for me anyway, it's always been kind of hard to find a set of rules that hits all the points that I need for a naval wargame. There are extraordinarily complex set of rules out there, stuff like Seakrieg 5, which is actually kind of my preference. There's a lot of math in terms of the combat mechanics in that game and whether a shell penetrates armor, things like that. And then there's the other end of the difficulty scale, which would be something like Mongoose Games, Victory at Sea, and they have a World War I set of rules called Dreadnought that we played once. And that's a little too simplistic for me, but what I have to do anyway is to find a set of rules that strikes the right balance between historical accuracy and detail and playability, because unfortunately not everybody that I game with, not thinking of anyone in particular, cares for the really complex chart-based, math-based kind of games that Seakrieg is. And Naval Thunder Battleship Row kind of hits all the good points. It's got enough detail to make it, I don't know if I want to say realistic exactly, but it's got enough detail to satisfy the naval enthusiast. But it's easy to play too. The detail doesn't get in the way of the game, which is a tough balance for a game designer, I think, to hit. You can play, I don't know, we played a game of Naval Thunder the other weekend in the amount of time it probably would have taken to play three turns in Seakrieg just because of all the complexity of it. Naval Thunder, like I say, it strikes the right balance between detail and playability, for me anyway.
Well, let's dive into Naval Thunder. So, you're actually the person who introduced me to it, which is part of the reason why I wanted to have you on for this episode. So why don't we talk about how you were able to discover it and why you chose it instead of some of the other games? Because I know that your background is really for the more in-depth sort of old-school war games that people of my age may not necessarily be so inclined to do.
Yeah, finding it was easy. I Googled World War II naval warfare rules, and it came up on the first page of Google Hits. So I checked it out. It's available as a PDF download only from might only be available from I can't think of the name of the link now.
Wargame Vault?
Yeah, Wargame Vault. It's not expensive. But the designer of the game, whose name I can't recall either, I'm sorry about that, but he has there's a couple of YouTube videos that are available on it. So I found the rules on War Games Vault, watched a couple of videos. There's a couple of, if you go to YouTube, you can find them, just search on Naval Thunder Battleship Row. A couple of guys have done video reviews of the rule sets in action, and it looked good. And it wasn't expensive, so it wasn't, it wasn't a big risk to try it. So I downloaded them and, read through them and found out that they were just about what I had been looking for. Like I said, the detail is there. It's enough to keep me satisfied. And the playability is there as well. The base rules are very simple. There's a lot of optional rules that you can add that we really haven't done in the games we've played yet that add more detail and complexity to it. But even if you included all of those rules, it really wouldn't affect the playability that much. It's a very well done set of rules.
Well, one of the things that I really enjoyed about it when you presented it to me was that you can get it, and I think you might be right, the only way that you can get it is as a PDF download online. I happen to look, Wargame Vault sells it, it's normally $24.95, but they have it on sale, $17.95 for it from Steel Dreadnought Games, and then that's for the core game. So they also have expansions that allow you to add on other nationalities, and then they have a World War One version, I think, as well. So you can kind of get like all this.
Yeah, they do.
And I mean, there'll be a link in the show notes for people, to it, or you can just go to, wargamingrecon.com/store and then do a search and you should be able to, find it on there. But I think being able to get it digitally not only makes it more accessible, but I think it, because of that, of course it has to be cheaper than if you went to a store and you bought like a bound packet or whatever. Like we go to the Hobby Bunker in Malden, which is just outside of, Boston, Mass, and they have a whole side of a rack for rules.
Yeah.
Some of them are hardcover and some of them are, you know, stapled or whatever in various degrees. But I'm always amazed by how expensive they are. Even the ones that don't have a whole lot of production value into them, they're 25, 30, 40 bucks, 50 bucks maybe. And I mean, like you said, you can try this, the cost for both in terms of actual money, but in terms of potential disappointment and willingness for risk is very low.
Yeah, it is with PDF sets of rules. The other thing about the PDF sets of rules that I like, and to be honest, I prefer a bound rule book, but the great thing about the PDF availability is, you know, instant gratification. Kind of like books on your Kindle or whatever. You don't have to leave the house, go to the store, hope they have it, and, or wait, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks for it to ship from England or wherever the publisher happens to be. So that's a nice aspect of the PDF rules too. And that's actually one of the reasons I figured, you know, I can blow 25 bucks here and, I'll know right away whether it's worth the money or not. Unfortunately it was. So.
Well, I agree with you. I'm someone, I like the physical object of it. Despite doing all this digital kind of stuff, podcasting and everything else, I'm very much an analog kind of guy. And yet, as much as I would love to have the rules in that physical format, nicely bound or whatever, so that I could mark up if I wanted, it is easy to do kind of like what you've done. You have them all printed out, you get them in a nice binder, you can get a 3-ring binder pretty cheap, you put it in there, and then if you wanted to mark up, you can get those sleeves and use those dry erase markers, or you can just write in pen or something, or pencil, and then print out a new copy of that page if you ever needed to.
Yep.
So why don't we talk about some of the games that we actually played with this. But before we do, I think we should talk about the prep that goes into it. So for example, it has some Excel sheets, spreadsheets that allow you to print out the data, that you need for the different ships and everything.
Yeah, it does. All the ship data cards, there's a different data card for each class of ship, battleship, crew, whatever. Every ship has its own, data card. This has all of its stats in regards to, kind of ship it is, the speed, the armor value, any aircraft if it has any, the type of guns it has, the layout of the guns. So as anybody who's familiar with naval gaming would know, the arrangement of the guns makes a big difference as to how you're facing, which gun can actually shoot. And it has all the gun statistics on the card in regards to range, amount of damage. But there's a different card for each ship, and they're available, they're in an Excel spreadsheet. But in addition to the Excel spreadsheet, you also get, when you buy the rules, they have a clever little program, which is actually an Excel program, that will print the cards for you, so you don't have to lasso the tables in Excel and print them out individually. The card printer program will do it for you. You can print, I think it's 3 ships on a sheet, mm-hmm. and you just enter the identity number of the ship into this program, and it will put all the stats for that ship on a sheet that you can then print out. It's very handy. So, but with the basic game, you get the United States fleet and the Japanese. There is an expansion that adds British, German, French, and Italian ships. And I ended up buying both the base game and the expansion set. So we have all the ships available. But in order to play a game, you have to figure out, it's slightly inconvenient in that you can't just kind of go to the store or wherever you're going to play and do it off of the hook. You have to know the scenario you're going to play in advance and print out the ship data cards for the ships that are going to be involved. So there's just a tiny bit of pre-planning before you can go out and play. You can't just show up and, oh, hey, let's play with these ships because you're going to have the cards for them. But that's not a big deal.
I actually like it. I mean, I played around with it a little bit, and at first glance, trying to figure out how to access the cards and how to get them to go into that Excel program to print out and everything. It's a little confusing, but there's a text file that's included with it that explains what you need to do. But yep. The reason why I really like it, and we'll talk more about this in a little bit, but is a result of that game that we played a weekend or two ago, depending on when people listen to this, but that we played at the Hobby Bunker in Malden. One of the listeners, Adam, is playtesting a scenario using these rules for the Hobby Bunker game day for 2015. And so he had printed them all out, and he didn't really know how the players were going to divide up the forces. There's enough of a complement for your forces on each side where it can be two people on a side, or I think he's even envisioning 3-2 or 3-3. But what you can actually do is, as a designer, whether you're creating the scenario or you're just going to GM the event, you can group what vessels you think are likely to work together or likely that a player will use and group them onto the same sheet. So that way you don't have to pass around stuff so much. And I mean, like, when we played in his lane, he had no idea how it was going to be divided up or whatever. So my fellow compatriot and I, when we were okay, we're the Americans and we're going to do this and that, and we divided up stuff. He didn't really have an idea, so he just kind of had it listed, I think, not necessarily in a particular order. Maybe he did have it in order, just not one I noticed. But well, so you can say, like, well, this is probably going to be a task force. It'll be, you know, this carrier, maybe these destroyers, whatever. And you put the stuff grouped together on your sheet. So you have, say, one or two sheets of them. And that way, player A has those sheets, and it's not like, I need your sheet for this, and can you have that and pass around? Or something like the Axis and Allies were at sea, which I know for many people, not really a naval game, but you have all those cards and you're like, well, here's your card and here's this and that. And it's a lot of shuffling of stuff. It takes up time.
Yeah.
Whereas with the pre-planning on this, I think you get that done and out of the way. You give it to the players. And if you want the ships to be organized in a certain way, you can say, this is your group. This is your task force, your fleet, your flotilla, whatever. This is what you are in charge of. Here's your sheet or sheets. And that it's all contained together. So being able to have that all grouped together, I think it makes it easier and more accessible for the player, so that they're not like, well, I think this stuff I need, but I can't keep that in mind because I don't have that. And how is that going to play in the game? And so they have what they need right there. It's easy is really what it is.
Yeah. Yep. So,
but like you said, you do have to do that pre-planning as, whoever has the rules or who's creating the event. You have to have that done before, and it's not like you can do with one of the other rule systems where you just pop open the rule book. Oh, here's all the stuff. Write this down or whatever. So yeah. On the plus side, it saves you all that time from writing. But on the negative, you got to be prepared. And if you're a player and your GM's not necessarily prepared on that, it might help to have someone with a backup who can have it, or even a tablet, actually, because you could probably pull this stuff up on a tablet too.
Yeah, you could. I mean, if you wanted to, you could bring it up on a tablet, or if you take a notebook with you, you could probably just make a copy of the Excel sheet and then do all the work on the tablet or on the computer if you wanted to. I mean, I think that'd be a bit of a pain, but yeah, you could do that.
So we played a few games of this. We played, two, and then the one that we just briefly mentioned from last time.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about them a little bit, about what kind of equipment you need in order to play, gaming aids, size of table, all that
okay.
sort of stuff.
Yeah, we can do that. We'll talk a little bit about how the rules work first, too. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So it's a phased game, and the turns are broken down into steps. And you have at the very start of the game, you have what's called the air and submarine combat phase. And then after that is done, the turns are broken down into a battleship phase, cruiser phase, and a destroyer phase. Movement is, well, there's different ways you can do the movement in the rules. We usually use the plotted movement version, but the different types of ships take their actions in the different phases. So in the battleship phase, the first thing that happens is everybody who's playing a battleship or a ship that's classed as a battleship, which would also include aircraft carriers, they plot their movement. And then after all the battleship players have plotted their movement, they move their ships. And then still in the battleship phase, now all the battleships get to shoot. And all the actions within a phase are simultaneous. So if one battleship shoots at another and sinks it, the battleship that was sunk gets to shoot back. Once the battleships are done, then the cruisers and destroyers operate in their phases, taking the same steps, plot, movement, fire, plot, movement, fire. Actions that occur outside of a phase are not simultaneous. So if a battleship shoots at a cruiser and sinks the cruiser, then when you get around to the cruiser phase of movement and firing, that ship is gone. It doesn't get to take any actions. So the battleships do have a bit of an advantage over the other ships. Cruisers have an advantage over destroyers. And then at the end of, after everybody's taken the phase, there is a end turn phase. And during that turn, or during that phase, things like damage control of the ships occur. Any ships that are required to take a command check to see if they disengage from the battle, things like that happen. So, but the games we played, the first one we played was a very simple battle. It was, the Battle of Denmark Strait, which is, Bismarck and Prince Eugen versus Prince of Wales and Hood. And it's a small battle. It's a good way to introduce people to the rules. So that's why we chose that one. And the outcome was, as I recall, ahistorical. So Hood and Prince of Wales won when we played it. I also played that scenario with, I don't know if you listened, but John Caputo. And, the outcome was ahistorical there as well. Hood and Prince of Wales sank the Bismarck. So, but it's, like I say, it's a small scenario. There's a battleship and cruiser on the German side and, battleship and battle cruiser on the British side. Battle cruisers operate a little bit differently from battleships. They fire with battleships, but they move in the cruiser phase. So they move as cruisers, and it's to your advantage, a lot of times to move second. So
that first game I thought was pretty interesting because, like you said, the results weren't what we know from the history books.
Right.
But it's a great way to kind of dive into this because I think a lot of people, might say, well, yeah, the price point's low and, these guys are saying it's fun and we should play and this and that. But like, should we really, if you take the chance, this is a good way, I think. And I think this is actually a perfect scenario to use for like a demo at a game day or at a convention or whatever. It's something small to whet people's appetite for it. It's iconic too. And that's one thing I like about the rules. You can recreate these iconic battles and you can do it pretty easily. And yep. I think they do, a faithful, insofar as you keep in mind the type of game this is, that it's not as in-depth as Sea Creek, for example. But it's not completely bare pretzels either.
It's not.
I think it really does do that great job of threading the needle. And so you're able to get people and you're like, hey, come on, let's play. And they see the stuff on the table and I think they're willing to take a chance. And one of the problems, I think, with naval wargaming in general is it's not very visually appealing.
No, it's not. I mean, it doesn't matter how nice your models are. You've got, a couple of ship models on probably a piece of blue felt. And it's not likely there's going to be, for most of these battles, it's not likely there's going to be any terrain around. I mean, if you're doing like Guadalcanal, Savo Island, okay, you might have some land masses around. But if you compare, naval gaming, at least World War II naval gaming to, I don't know, pick any tabletop World War II game, Flames of War, bolt action, whatever. Yeah, the visual appeal just, it's not there, unfortunately.
Well, I just think about, this year, how's that 2015 going around? There was tons of naval war games, and I'm sure they were a lot of fun. I didn't take photos of them because, I mean, the ships are one whatever hundredth scale, 126, one whatever. And no matter how nice the table surface itself is, it's blue, right? You can't do a whole lot with the ocean.
Yeah.
And so you get these tiny little things on there and they're doing these epic stuff. But at least what you can do, if you know that there's this handicap to naval wargaming for the visual appeal, the eye candy, so to speak, you can pick something that people know that has a great story with it. And I think you have that with the venturing of the Bismarck out as like this last great hope for, the Third Reich trying to inflict some sort of damage on the Allies to get into their convoys and just wreak havoc. And yet they know it's hopeless, but they gotta try, right? And the British, they can't allow this to happen. So you have this huge story and then we have all these documentaries and movies that have been done about it. So you have all that whole mythos and, excitement that people get. And then you have these fantastic gunfights is really what they are. It's two cowboys hanging out down Main Street shooting at each other. But where Main Street is many, many, many miles apart, they're just lobbing shells and stuff. So you have that. And I think you need to go with something recognizable when you do naval wargaming. And I think even with this, like if you're playing with just, if it was just you and I, we had an interest in, some little minutia somewhere, this like, tiny little thing that took place nowhere and people don't care about, That's one thing. But if you want to make it appeal to other people, you really have to pick something iconic, I think. And this helps you. This set of rules really, I think, gears itself towards that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the prepared scenarios they have in the rule book and in the expansion set, yeah, that's what they have in there is all the battles that everyone has heard of. And that's fine because everybody wants to refight those battles. I mean, everybody wants to see if they can beat the Bismarck, which as it turns out is not that difficult. The Bismarck, the Germans won the Battle of Denmark Strait because the Bismarck, or some people actually say Prince Eugen, got lucky and blew the hood up. That was actually kind of an uneven fight. You had two British battleships versus a battleship and a heavy cruiser. And just in terms of number, you know, weight of shot, that's just not fair. But anyway, the Germans in real life got lucky, but in the games that we've played to simulate that action, they didn't. So they lose. But no, you're right. In terms of appeal, particularly at a convention or something like that, I do think you have to do something recognizable. There's a lot of the appeal of these, well, any war games rules really is that you can do, what if type scenarios. A lot of ships that were designed to fight each other never actually saw each other. I mean, take a look at the Japanese battleships, Yamato, Musashi. Everybody wants to play those ships. The only thing they did in real life was sail out of Yokosuka and get sunk, but that's no fun. So. So you can, you know, scale your matchups. Oh, what would have happened if, Iowa and Missouri had met Musashi and Yamato? Things like that. So there's a lot of appeal to that. But I think, like you say, at a convention, people tend not to be, and I don't know why, but they tend not to be hugely interested in what if type stuff like that. Fantasy wargaming, if you want to call it that. So, but yeah.
One of the things that I was surprised by with the set of rules was that, and I like it a lot. At first I was like, really? This is what you need? You need D10s. You can't just use a bunch of D6s or whatever you have laying around. You need the D10s. It makes perfect sense, right? For the percentages.
Yeah, it does. You do oftentimes need a lot of D10s, but it still makes much more sense to me than the D6 methodology. That's kind of, not to go off on a tangent, but that's kind of one of the hard spots I have with a lot of newer sets of rules where you roll literally a fistful of D6s and modify all the dice based on this, that, and the other thing, whether it's terrain, range, whatever. It irritates me. I don't understand it because all you're trying to do is recreate or boil this dice rolling down to a certain percentage. What is your chance to hit? What is your chance to damage? So just use 2d10 and come up with a freaking percentage. I don't know why they don't do that. I don't know if they have stock in ChessX and in the dice companies or what the deal is, but for every game nowadays, it seems like you need a couple of those, crates of six-sided dice. It's annoying, but it is what it is. But yeah, it's unusual to find a game that actually uses D10s.
People like to roll dice, or people of a certain age enjoy rolling dice.
It could be that. It could be, you know, the Warhammer. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. Maybe if you're rolling a lot of dice, it feels like you're actually doing something. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But yeah, it's just the way game development is going these days. There's, unless I develop my own game, there's nothing I can do about it. So I'll stop complaining about it.
With this game, one thing that I've noticed is, and I think this is a perfect way to kind of handle it. It's hard to cause damage on your opponent, but once you do, it seems like you do a lot of damage.
It can be hard to cause damage on your opponent, depending on who's shooting at who, but you're right. When you do hit a ship, and if that shell that you hit with penetrates, the damage is pretty catastrophic pretty quickly, which, you know, makes sense. You're talking about a battleship shooting at a battleship or a cruiser or whatever. You have a 15-inch shell, it weighs about a ton, and it penetrates your ship and explodes inside. Yeah, that's going to cause some damage. So, yeah, you're right. It's difficult to hit in the game. Your hit numbers can be extremely high. Like, if say you're talking on a die 10, your base hit number is, for a cruiser, say, an 8+. So on a die 10, you have to roll an 8+. So you're starting out, you've only got a 20% chance to hit the ship. And then with modifiers and whatnot, your hit number can quickly go to 11 or 12, which the game does allow you to roll that number. You have to roll a 10, then followed by a 6 or an 8 or whatever to actually make that quote-unquote impossible shot. So it is very difficult to hit, but yeah, you're right. When you do hit, the damage adds up very quickly, and that's kind of one of the aspects of the game that's appealing. People tend not to have a lot of time nowadays, and so ships die in Naval Thunder pretty quickly, particularly ships like destroyers that don't have a lot of armor, a destroyer can be sunk in one shot. So, as we saw the other weekend.
Well, a battleship too.
Yeah, depending. It was actually a cruiser, but yeah, the cruiser that I was running, got hit, had flooding, and then took on a severe list, and then at the end phase, you have to roll to see if you get the flooding under control. The problem is, if you have a list, and your damage control roll ends up being list, the ship actually capsizes and sinks. And that's what happened to me. And that ship that ship got hit by one shot, and it was out of the game, so.
Well, I actually was thinking about the second time we played Denmark Strait, and I think the Bismarck, actually, the second time, sunk the Hood, I think, with a one shot. Got in, but I think it was a fire situation. Got fire on a catastrophic table. It got flooding on a catastrophic table. Got the list. The fire kept on going. And then somewhere or other something else happened. And then boom, it's gone.
Yeah, it doesn't take much. Because all the things that we're talking about here, the fire, the flooding, those are all ongoing damage effects. So if you catch on fire, then okay, you take immediate damage from the fire and there's a damage control chart that you have to roll on. Now you might put the fire out. Or you might not. And if you don't, then you continue to take fire from that damage, or damage from that fire or flooding every turn until you get it under control. And if you are unlucky in your dice rolls and never get it under control, the ship just burns up. So, and that's what happened in that situation. And the second game we played was, Battle of the River Platte, which is Crouch Bay versus three British cruisers, a heavy and two lights. And, the heavy cruiser was taken out immediately by Graf Spee in one broadside. And that's part of the problem that you have to deal with in the game. Whereas if you have a cruiser taking on a heavier ship, although Graf Spee was actually more or less considered a cruiser, it did have 11-inch guns as opposed to the 8-inch or 6-inch guns that most cruisers are armed with. Basically, that ship doesn't have to roll for penetration on a cruiser type target. The penetration value on its guns are such that every shot that hits penetrates and does full damage. And as I recall, you hit with every shot and it wiped the heavy cruiser out in one shot. So results in Battleship Row can be very quick. I shouldn't say results, but once ships start taking damage, like we said, they don't tend to last long.
Well, it depends though. And this is one of the things that I think is almost genius about it. And I'm sure other rules have this, but you're not going to take a ship out just by shooting at it. And obviously, yes, you are, but the damage that you inflict just from the shot, not from any extras from the catastrophic table or whatever, just from actually hitting it, 9 times out of 10 is not going to be enough in a game to take down a ship, because a big ship, 150 hull points, 40 hull points, whatever, it's just not going to do it, because these hits, if you penetrate, they're doing full points, 6 or 10 or something like that, but otherwise they do it half, 2, 3, 4, so you're not going to take the ship, but where you do it is when you do penetrate and when you roll on that catastrophic table. And yet that's another roll you got to do. So yeah, you hit it and you're going to do some points of damage, but the big and the wow factor really, I think, is when you roll on that catastrophic table and you're looking to see, did you roll a 20? Is it, the ammunition? Does it go boom? Is it sinking? Well, bridge hit. Are they losing guns, main guns, secondary guns, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And that actually kind of reminds me of the old GW game, Battlefleet Gothic, where they had this fantastic table on what was going to happen. And just like even the percentages, I think for Battlefleet Gothic table, I feel were very similar to what you needed in this, and for similar results.
Yeah.
But coming from that whole GW background, it was hard for me, even after all these years of not really playing any GW games, for me to look and say, "Wait, I need an 8 on a 10-sided die to hit you."
Yeah.
like that's hard. But after you do it for a little while, you realize, okay, actually that makes sense. And it's okay, and you will hit them, and you might not think you're going to, but 9 times out of 10, you do. And, you don't need to be rolling 6-sided dice and saying, oh, I need a 3+, I need a 4+. you roll that D10 and you need the 8 out of 10, but then with the modifiers, depending on the scenario, is it at night, what's nearby, all that sort of stuff, what guns, how close are you? You can get it down to 6+ or whatever, and you see how it goes, and I'm surprised by how often you actually do hit.
Yeah, no, it's true. You can, particularly when the ranges get close, it gets very easy to hit and easier to penetrate the armor. So, But you're right. The big damage comes from, like, a battleship, like you say, will have anywhere from 130, 150 hit points. You got to peck away at that thing for a long time unless you get some lucky rolls on the critical hits table. And that is where kind of like you say, the excitement or the wow factor of the game comes in, because any shot that penetrates the ship's armor has a chance to just roll a 20 on the critical hit table and just blow it up. It's gone. So, yeah.
So about how long would you say an average game takes? About how many turns?
It depends on how many ships, obviously, and more players are going to bog it down. But I would say that for a decent sized scenario with maybe 4 to 5 ships on the side and just 2 players handling them, you could finish a game in probably 3 hours. It doesn't take long to set up. I mean, obviously you're not setting up a lot of terrain, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'd say about 3 hours play time for something like that, 2 to 3 hours.
Well, that game we played the other day, for Adam, I think we started at what, say 10:30 in the morning. We were done by 12:30, 1, something
about
like
1 o'clock, I think. Yeah. So 2.5 hours. And that was a big scenario. But what happened there is the objective of that scenario is to sink one particular ship. You have to sink the carrier Saratoga, and we fired a Hail Mary shot, a torpedo shot at the Saratoga, hit it, and rolled the 20 for the magazine explosion, so game over. But
yeah.
But yeah, if that hadn't happened, that game would have gone on for several more turns at least. So,
well, why don't we talk a little bit about what we think some of the strengths or weaknesses are with this game? Because, I mean, nothing's perfect, right, in life? There's always improvement.
Nothing's perfect. So let's talk about the weaknesses first. There's only one glaring weakness as far as I can see, and that is the way the game handles aerial combat and submarine combat is, it's very abstract. It's probably an accurate representation. But so air combat, we'll start with air combat in particular. So if you have a fleet with a couple of carriers in it, these carriers have their air wings. And before the game starts, there are 2 what they call air phases. So on a sheet of paper with your pencil, you decide how you're going to allocate your air forces. You have a certain number of fighters, torpedo planes, dive bombers, maybe level bombers. And on this tracker sheet, which I'd show you one if I had one. I don't have one printed out. But you decide, okay, these fighters are going to be supplying combat cap, combat air patrol over my carriers. These fighters are going to be escorting the bombers. These torpedo planes are going to, and you allocate your air forces how you're going to. And then while you're doing that, the enemy player, if he happens to have carriers as well, he's doing the same thing. So now the air phase begins, and there's no more, you could play this part of the game over the phone if you wanted to. There's no models or anything involved. So you've allocated your bombers in a certain way. He has his fleet aligned. He knows what his anti-aircraft values of his ships are. And you just roll some dice and find out before the game actually starts how much of your fleet has been damaged or sunk by the airstrike. The other player does the same thing. If you have fighters escorting your bombers, then there's a phase of the air battle that, you know, how many planes has he lost? And that you do that phase and then tally up the results from that. Then you do it again. This is before the game even starts. And it's completely abstract. Like I said, you can do it over the phone. It's dice and paper. If naval air combat is your thing, if that's what you really want a naval game for, although the results that are generated by that air combat phase are probably accurate and realistic and maybe even fun to a certain extent, Battleship Rogue probably isn't the set of rules that you want to use for that. It's completely abstract.
I think the word you're looking for is boring.
I'm not sure that it would be boring necessarily. Well, maybe it would be boring.
It's basically a theoretical exercise.
It is. And then in the middle of the game, at some point, and it can be determined randomly, usually it's determined randomly, there's a third airstrike phase. So while the fleets are in contact and shooting at each other, the aircraft may show up and do another strike. The carriers are completely abstract. If you want to, before the fleets actually engage in surface combat, you can disengage your carriers from the battle and just, they never appear, you just send them off. And herein, there is another abstract part of the game, and that's submarines. If the enemy has submarines available, and your carriers go off on their own without escorts, he gets to roll random dice against your carriers to see if his submarine sank them. You can choose to have your carriers escorted by destroyers or cruisers, and that lessens the other player's chances with his subs, but then your surface fleet is correspondingly weaker. And all of that makes sense. It's just not very fun, I don't think. And submarines are the same way. They're very abstract. Basically, before the game, it's the same thing as the carriers. It's a dice roll. Did you sink anybody? Okay. By pure luck, I sank your biggest ship. So Yamato is not going to be in the surface battle. Sorry. That is definitely the biggest weakness of the game, in my opinion. But if you buy the rules with the intent that you're just going to not worry so much about the air combat, not worry so much about submarines. I mean, submarines in fleet action are really an anomaly anyway. That just didn't happen that often. It's not how they were used. It's how they were intended to be used at the beginning of the war, but that ended up not being the case. But if you buy the rules just with the idea that you're going to fight surface actions and keep the air combat completely in the back of your mind as only maybe an occasional thing, Battleship Row is a great set of rules.
I agree. I was very surprised when you had first explained to me how air combat worked, mainly because my previously favorite naval war game, or naval miniatures war game, was that Baron Pretzel one, Axis and Allies War at Sea, where you have your planes and they launch from your aircraft carriers or from land bases, and you have the little plane models and they go and they're attacking and dive bombing or torpedo bombing. And the same with the U-boats or whatever other subs you have.
Yep.
And I mean, I get that that's not necessarily accurate, but then again, we're moving little toy soldiers basically around on a tabletop. So,
yeah.
You know, I think you can give leeway for these sort of things if it's going to enhance the playing value, if it's going to make it more fun, if it's going to maybe become more appealing to more people. But there's nothing wrong with having that niche where you do it really well. And I really do agree with you that the biggest weakness for this is also its biggest strength, in that you have these two things that, I mean, just sit down at home and write it out and say, this is how it is, guys. We're doing the fun part now. We're doing the whatever. I did the homework.
Right.
But it allows you to concentrate on the excitement of ship-to-ship combat.
Right.
And you look back in history from the beginning of time when there was naval combat to now, that's where the excitement is. You have these stories, John Paul Jones, you know, fighting, and you have just like these characters and stuff, and then it continues on. And I mean, it does become a little more abstract as we move further along in time, because the ships are further and further apart. They don't see each other. I mean, radar and so forth. But that's where the fun is. Did I hit? Did I get to do this? Let me send a couple of planes over and do that or whatever. If you want air combat, play an aerial game. Play Wings of War. Play Chicky Six. Play like any of those, right? Because they're good and they do that.
They are. If that's what you want to focus on, yeah, you're better off doing that. I mean, I will say in their defense, the way that Battleship Row handles air combat makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, if you look at a battle like Coral Sea or Midway, the surface fleets never even saw each other. And even in actions where the surface fleets did eventually engage, all the aerial combat happened beforehand, just like they do it in the game. So like I say, the way they handle it is absolutely correct, I would say. Just isn't any fun. So, and I hate the idea that half your fleet can be sunk before the game actually even starts. That drives me out of my mind. So as a consequence, I probably won't be playing too many games of Battleship Row where air power takes a big role. But you could look at it as an advantage in one way. You don't have to buy any plane models and paint them, and I hate painting, so, you know, yay.
But one of the things that I liked about this too was that scale-wise, I mean, you have a wide array of options that you can do. And one thing that we've done, because I basically don't paint, and you don't like to paint, is that we've used all those old Axis and Allies War at Sea models that have tons and tons of them. Spent way too much money on that way back in the day. But breathe a new life into it and use it for this. And this is a set of rules that, for me anyway, I could see playing for years to come, just time and time and time again.
Yeah, I think so. It's a lot of fun. It plays fast and it's easy. Yeah, it's a very good set of rules for surface actions. And yeah, it is nice to be able to recycle the War at Sea ships. They're a little large scale wise. They tend to need a slightly bigger playing area. But I mean, even at that, a 6x4 table works fine. So yeah, no, it's nice.
And, it sounds like it has the Adrian Benson, endorsement behind this.
Yeah, I would say so. Absolutely. I mean, with the one caveat of, if you're the kind of guy that is all about air power, might want to look somewhere else. But yeah, this is a great set of rules. I really love it.
Well, if you're all about air power, you're probably not going to play a naval war game in so much as other types of games.
Well, what I mean is if you're looking to, like, if you want to recreate the Battle of Midway, this wouldn't be the best set of rules to do it, because you don't even need any models. You just need a sheet of paper and a handful of 10-sided dice. So.
And yet, do you know what? That has a perfect market for solo wargaming. A lot of people
like
it.
It actually does. It actually does. I mean, if you wanted to, in fact, I hadn't thought of that until that just came out of your mouth. But yeah, that would be an excellent, that wouldn't be a bad solo exercise at all.
I think it's important to always look for that silver lining.
Yeah.
So if the people at Still Dreadnought Games ever listen to this, you can send a check made payable to Adrian Benson, courtesy of Wargaming, and, you know, a little something my way too wouldn't be remiss. No, but seriously, I love the Rose. And when you first introduced them, cause I mean, you know what kind of gamer I am. I think the way you described it was something like, there's this rule set that we can use for Naval Wargaming. It has charts, but don't worry, cause it's not that bad. You'll be okay with it. I was like, are you sure? And to be honest, I don't think I believed you until we actually started playing. But you're right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a great set of rules. It's a lot of fun. It's affordable, on Wargame Vault. We'll have a link in the show notes. But make sure you do like what Adrian did. If you get it, get Battleship Row, which is a core game. As of the time we were recording this, it's on sale for $17.95. But also get Bitter Rivals, which is a X-Pack on it for $14.95 on sale. And another cool thing that I like about this, manufacturer is they also have a space version, I'm going to call it, but for, why can't I think of the name? A BSG, Battlestar Galactica. I mean, not officially Battlestar Galactica. They don't have the license for that, but it's basically Battlestar Galactica that you can play. So Colonial Battlefleet is the name of the rules, but everyone knows what it is, right?
Absolutely.
And again, that's cheap too, $14.95 for that. And then they have the World War One stuff, Clash of Dreadnoughts or something like that, I think they call it. So, I mean, it's a lot of fun. It's affordable. I would say that Adam from his playtesting stuff is a big fan of it. I think he would probably give it an endorsement too. And, my one suggestion for them for improvement, if they ever get enough business, is to do even just a limited print run of it. Make it available from some local game stores or something.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Well, I think it's time for us to move on to our mailbag section of the show. So, this is one of my favorite parts because as many of you probably know, I love hearing from all of you. I love getting feedback and just love seeing what's going on with everyone. That's one of the cool things I think about doing a podcast as opposed to say like a real radio station or whatever. You don't get to interact with them so much. You know, you're listening to whatever station you like or, you're listening to that, news station. You don't get to interact with the people on there. You don't get to hear from them. They don't really get to hear from you so much, but with the podcast you do. So that's really cool. And we have a Facebook page set up. So we've received some comments on Facebook recently. First is one from Chris Kendrick, who's owner of the Historical Wargames Exchange Facebook group. And he left a comment in regards to episode 137. He said, quote, many thanks, Jonathan, for your efforts. Wombat stamp for you. Well, thank you very much, Chris, for your comment. The Wombat stamp is kind of like a seal of approval on the Historical Wargames Exchange group. Just a little fun thing that they do. So there's an image on there. If you look back far enough, you see an image from him, and it's a wombat for me. I don't know what I'll do with said wombat. Maybe it'll end up on the site or something. And then listener Adam, who we've actually been talking about a little bit in this episode, said of episode 140, which was the How to Survive Your Friendly Local Game Store Closing, he said, quote, very good show. And he also has a handful of local Massachusetts game stores listed and kind of analyzed on his blog, Fencing Frog Blog, which is over on Blogspot. Kind of gives his take about the places he games at and his collective game stores, he's got to speak. There's a lot of great ones there, and I'm sure people all over the place have fantastic game stores. And then also on episode 140, listener Arthur from the Tabletop War Games Network Facebook group had a suggestion. He suggested that we do an episode on how to save your friendly local game store. And I want to say that I've added it to the list, and that's going to be done at a later date. And do you know what, Arthur? You're right. We can't just talk about what happens when your game store dies, because game stores do die, but they survive too, right? Adrian, I think you and I have each had game stores that have gone kaput on us and others that continue to thrive, and so it's kind of cool to see.
Yep.
And then let's see what else we got. I want to let everyone know that the show is made possible by Audible. If you head over to wargamingrecon.com/audible, you can get a free audiobook download of your choice with a free 30-day trial of Audible. Right now I am listening, or actually I just finished listening to Without You, There Is No Us. And it's this nonfiction audiobook that's pretty amazing. It's about North Korea. This woman who's a writer and a journalist, she goes undercover as a Christian missionary to teach English to the children, the boys of the North Korean elite. And you get this insight into North Korea that people don't normally get, because I mean, there's this iron curtain around the country. And I think a lot of us would say they're probably delusional, but this, this book actually, it emphasizes that, but it also shows you that there's this heart behind there. And at the end of the day, they're just people who, through no fault of their own, they've been brainwashed by the government there. It's a good story. So I would recommend that. And, you can pick any other sort of audiobook that you like. You get it for free. That's wargamingrecon.com/audio, audible. So many things to choose from. And if you do this, not only do you get your free audiobook and a free 30-day trial of Audible, which is a great service, but by doing it, you're actually helping out the show because, for each of you who signs up, we get, I think it's $15 that helps us to keep going. But it actually doesn't cost you anything because if you sign up, you get your free audiobook, you pick whatever you like, and then cancel your membership before the 30 days are up, it never costs you anything. So it's perfect, actually. And then for me anyway, like I don't get to read as much, but audiobooks are a way I can digest a lot of stuff, either in the car or when I'm at work. Adrian, I know you have like, what is it, 45 minutes an hour to get to work?
Yeah, depending.
Audiobook would be perfect for you to spend your time on your commute. Yeah. Instead of getting frustrated at all the other commuters who don't know how to drive.
Oh, no, I don't do that. I'm a very tolerant person.
Oh, of course you are. But, you know, sometimes the stress of of being on the road, it gets people. It's like being out in the Jutland Waste. It makes a person go a little crazy. But really, Audible is a great service. And one really cool thing about them is they're an Amazon company. Amazon provides fantastic customer service, and you get that same amazing customer service from Audible. So really, I'm not suggesting it because they give us money. I mean, it's nice that they do. I'm suggesting it because they are amazing. It's a service I love and I believe in. And I love audiobooks. It's a great way to get through stuff. And then I want to remind everyone, there's still time for you to take the Great Wargaming Survey for 2015. Head on over to wargamingrecon.com/Great Wargaming Survey 2015. It'll take 5 to 10 minutes of your time, and you're answering questions about the hobby, about who you game with, kind of games you play, what are your favorite parts, do you like to game, do you like to make terrain, research, paint, and all that sort of stuff. And when you're done with the survey, you're going to get a 10% discount from the Karen's Hourly store. You can use it for anything there, really. But I say, why not use it for a 1-year digital subscription to War Game Soldiers and Strategy? If you use our special link, which is wargamingrecon.com/WSSdigital, you can get a free digital sub, normally $16.95. But if you use this 10% off, it only costs you $15 and change. And you get a whole year. If you buy the print, which I've done at the Hobby Bunker, it's $9 or $10 an issue. So you get an entire year for, you know, less than 3 print issues, which is a really good deal. So time's running out, so make sure you've done that. Did you end up actually doing the survey, Adrian? I mentioned it a few weeks ago.
You did, and I have not yet.
Well, you've got a little bit more time, so I suggest you go do it, because they're comparing results with last year, and there's some interesting trends that they're noticing. Jasper Orthoise of WSNS and the whole Karen Starway family is going to come on the show at a later time to talk about this year's survey and the results and kind of compare it with the 2014 one, which he had done. So it'll be cool to see what he has to say, what if any changes there are. And I mean, they've got tons of people who have responded, and now's your chance to be heard. It's not
any indication that people are moving away from the fistful of dice method and going back to regular percentages or?
Well, I can tell you that so far, and it's very, very, very early indication that all this talk about the graying of the hobby may be just talk, that it might not actually be taking place.
I hope that's true.
So I don't know if it is or isn't, but I look forward to diving into that with Jasper when he comes on the show. And, you know, if you think that's true or you think it's wrong, take the survey, answer the questions, and your input will help to kind of allow everyone really to take a look at this, I would say, very, very important issue, maybe even more important than growing the hobby, but related, and just see where it's going. Mm. And then I want to remind everyone, we have this live page, which is fantastic because you can watch live episodes of the show. I mean, Adrian and I are recording this live. By the time you hear it, it's not live anymore, but you can watch live. You can interact with us and each other and other listeners on our chat room. So you can get that by going to wargamingrecon.com/live. The next live episode of the show will take place on Saturday, August 8th at 1 o'clock. I'm going to have guest Aaron Bostian back on, and we're going to talk about Warhammer Fantasy Battles Age of Sigmar. I can honestly tell you that I never thought I would talk about Warhammer Fantasy or any GW product any time after the very earliest episodes of this. It's just not something I ever thought I would do. And not to give too much away, but I think Age of Sigmar could be the thing that gets me to play Warhammer Fantasy again. I don't want to give too much, but it's going to be amazing. And Aaron's done a lot of work with people down in Virginia growing the hobby there and using GW to do that. And so it's going to be a lively and interesting discussion because he and I don't necessarily agree on GW, but we're going to have a good analysis and review editorial, so to speak, of Age of Sigmar. And then I want to thank everyone who backs and supports Wargaming Recon on Patreon. So I want to thank Dave and the Wargames at Battleshades Facebook group for being Patreon backers. I want to let you know that you too can support us here via Patreon. Patreon's a cool way to do it because not only will you get episodes before everyone else, you get them first. You'll have access to a patron-only feed there, a backer-only feed where you can interact with me on there, share ideas and conversations and everything. And then you're helping the show to grow and the show to keep on doing stuff. So, for example, you can sign up. It doesn't cost anything. You can become a backer, and you can pay either with your PayPal account or with a credit debit card. If you are signing up with a PayPal account, I just want to let you know some backers have said that there's been some problems where their pledges aren't actually coming out. So if you want to make sure that your money is actually coming out of your account and actually helping us, make sure that you are all set up and that maybe don't use PayPal, but if you do, just make sure everything's working properly. And if it doesn't, either contact Patreon or you can contact me here. You have my email address, which I will give again later in the episode. And I'm very sad to say we've met our second goal. We have a bunch of different goals for things that we want to do to have better quality here so that when you listen to episodes, you're getting the best experience you can. So we met that second goal, and now we are just $10 away from reaching the next goal. And that goal is to obtain a digital scheduler. It doesn't sound fancy or exciting, right? It sounds as fancy as looking at a naval war game at a convention, right? But the cool thing about it is it streamlines the process for getting guests like Adrian here on the show so that I'm able to communicate with them, and they just respond on what times and everything works, and then it just fits into calendars and stuff, and it makes everything so much easier. And since it makes it easier and better both for me and for the guests, it means I can have more guests come on the show and have it done more frequently so that you get more cool people talking to you about all sorts of things that you care about. So that is just $10 away. And all it takes is 4 listeners backing at $3 per episode. And if you do that, not only will you help this goal to happen, but backing at that level means that you will be thanked by name in every single episode that you back. So whether it's on the live episode in the show notes, in the actual podcast and all that sort of stuff. So you have that. Or you can back as little as $1 an episode, which is roughly $2 a month. Head over to wargamingrecon.com/Patreon. Okay, so at the top of the show, I said, there's going to be a lot of stuff I'm throwing at you. This is all that stuff, but don't worry. Show notes. Head over to wargamingrecon.com/WR141. It has links to everything. You don't have to remember all of this. But I do want to say the next episode will come out August 17th. It is that episode with Aaron that I talked about, the Warhammer Fantasy Battles, Age of Sigmar. And, Adrian, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on this episode. It's always a joy having you on. Are you surprised that my next episode is going to be on Warhammer Fantasy?
I am a little surprised about that, but I have to say the whole revamp of the fantasy, it's got me interested too. And you know how I feel about GW. So we'll see.
I am glad I'm sitting down for that.
Yeah.
I think that just tells people in advance a little bit about what this could mean. I'm following all sorts of groups about Age of Sigmar because there's a lot of controversy and there's a lot of mean stuff being said by people about
this. Did you see the YouTube video of the guy setting fire to his fantasy army?
Oh, that I did. And I've joined a Facebook group called The Rage of Sigmar, and they post fantastic imagery and quotes from people. It's great. I don't want people to think I'm making light of it. It's just that, and I'll cover it in the episode with Aaron, but I've been here, right? Their problem is that GW said, okay, we're not doing what we've done before. We're not doing what Flames of War is doing. We're not doing what Privateer Press is doing, both of which have emulated, in my opinion, GW.
They're doing
what mainstream historical games are doing, saying, play what you want to play, play to have fun. And as difficult as it was for me way back in the day, and I've talked about this, to go from that GW metric and come into historicals where it's like, here you go swim, there's no lifeline or anything, just do whatever and try to find my way. That's what everyone else is experiencing. And it's hard to acclimate yourself to that, but once you do, you realize it's such a better and more wonderful world in which to game than being so restricted. So I find it amusing just because I'm like, I've been there. I did that. You're going to be okay. Don't worry about it. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And I figure a lot of listeners might be surprised and some might even be disappointed actually because of, I have firm opinions about GW and I haven't been afraid to express those over the years. It's nothing new. I wouldn't use the word bash, but I suppose some might say I have bashed GW, but I've also been a GW fanboy. So I've been all over the place, but I really enjoyed having you on for this episode. And I appreciate that you introduced me to this new game. It's a new favorite for me. It really is.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Thanks for having me back, John. It was fun.
Well, until next time, I want to remind everyone that you can, of course, get in touch through the usual ways. All that's in the show notes and everything. But no matter what you're doing in your life, no matter how busy you are, no matter how many times your ships get sunk because someone younger than you gets lucky and causes you to list and flood and list again and go beneath the waves, no matter what's going on, you need to keep on gaming. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Cast, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon and all of the other podcasts that you know and love. Or you can always stream and download the latest episode of Wargaming Recon by heading on over to the show notes for that episode.
Hey there, this is Ben Gerber from Troll in the Corner, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my podcast, Indie Talks. Indie Talks is a discussion about independent publishing, where we take a look at indie games, the people who write them, and the people who play them. We're going to branch a little farther afield as well and talk to some independent television and movie stars and creators, as well as crafters, all of who are related to gaming in some way, shape, or form. So please join me on the Troll in the Corner Network at trollitc.com and give Indie Talks a listen.
Are you a wargamer and want to know what to do when you're an Australian wargamer? Then you need to tune in to the Hobby Desk. For Australian wargamers, this is a member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network, and we're here to give you the best possible things that Australian wargamers can give to you, the listeners. And I hope you enjoy what we do, because guess what? It's coming more and more often and more awesome for you who listen to the Hobby Desk on the Troll in the Corner podcast network.
This is Andreas, Apprentice of the White Order. I would like to invite you to listen to my letters, a humble collection of my observations of the various beautiful and very, very dangerous creatures that inhabit my world. I hope you enjoy it as part of the Monsters of the Shattered World on Troll in the Corner at trollitc.com.
Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network. Visit www.trollitc.com for more information. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.